Accession number 18708, Reel 1.
This is an interview with Group Captain Arscott, a former Berlin Airlift pilot, recorded by Rodney Giesler on March the 2nd, 1999, for the Imperial War Museum Sound Archive. Right, can you tell me when you were born?
I was born on the 18th of September 1924, and I was born in Bournemouth.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell me a bit about your family background?
My family background comes from Blandford in Dorset. My father was a motor engineer and was the manager of Shamrock and Rambler coaches in Bournemouth.
The next thing, I presumably you joined the Royal Air Force because the war was on and you had to go into one of the services. And was that it? I mean, you didn't
no.
see your career there.
Well, I did. I wanted to be an aeronautical draftsman, but the war came. I've always been interested in aviation, and in 1938 I joined the Air Defence Cadet Corps. In fact, I was the first member in Bournemouth, which eventually became the Air Training Corps. And I became a warrant officer. I was the first a child warrant officer in the Air Defence Cadet Corps. The squadron consisted of 200 people and the Bournemouth Wing of over 1,000. We were very active. And it was from there, of course, not with the war going on, it was obvious that I would join the Air Force, which I joined in 1942. I joined and went through the initial training in this country, and then went to Canada to do my elementary flying training and my service training, SFTS. Which we did on a Canadian station. We were the first Brits to go on to a Canadian station, which I think was a cultural shock for the Canadians because we didn't do things quite the way that the Canadians would like us to do.
Can you instance?
Well, the one that it comes readily to mind is that they and the Americans used to make their beds up with their the blankets, then the sheets, then the blankets, then their sheets, then the blankets, which had to be absolutely a precise measurement, and they had to be absolutely square, where we tended just to make our beds up in the normal way, and they were horrified, but we didn't succumb to their requirements, and I think we were a bit of the thorn in their side, but we were very successful because. Where the normal people were straight from school, in our course we had a warrant officer electrician, two flight sergeants, air gunners who were converting to pilots, and 4 sergeants. So we were fairly forceful on the ground through them. We had a very very pleasant time.
What station did you train on?
We started at a place called Bowden, which is just north of Calgary. Then we went to a place called Estevan, which was near south of Winnipeg in the Dust Bowl. And as soon as we got there, we had a dust storm and they closed the station down. And we went to Dauphin, which is north of Winnipeg. Which was a Canadian station. And it was very interesting and very pleasant. From there, we went to Vancouver, to Abbotsford, to convert onto Mitchell's, which was what I had hoped to do, with, to come back onto 2nd ATAF, but the war was, the end of the war was in sight, so I volunteered for special duties and went out to the Far East on 358. 357 and 358 were the special duty squadrons in the Far East.
Was it usual to convert onto frontline aircraft over there?
Yes, and this was the... there was an OTU which did Mosquitoes, but this was the only other one in Canada where you actually did your conversion. We were supposed to fly out to the Far East, but some of our crew had been instructors and had been in Canada for 3 years already, and therefore we came back via the United Kingdom for a fortnight's leave before we went out on the Orion to India and then up into...
That was sort of a troop ship.
Yeah, yes, that's right.
And you staged across the Atlantic, what, via Iceland, did you? And
no, we didn't. We came back by ship again. A horrific journey back. We went out on the Queen Mary, and we came back on a ship which rolled and bucketed around the Atlantic, and it was a most uncomfortable return trip.
Anyway, you went out to the Far East with 357.
358.
358, flying Mitchells.
No. Flying, my speciality was the Liberator because it was the long distance one. All our trips in the Liberator, even the shortest, was about 14 hours. The longest I did was about 22 hours, all over what was then Siam and French Indochina. And you were given an area where you were responsible for any activities within that area, and mine were Saigon and Hanoi. So you used to take out the agents and drop them. The agents used to arrive, particularly with French Indochina, they tended to be Mackey people from France who would come out to us.
Europeans.
Who had no experience of flying, let alone being dropped out of an aircraft. They would arrive on, shall we say, day one, and our job was to show them how to jump out of an aircraft. We used to have a tower with a deployed canopy within the tower, and where they used to drop to the ground and hopefully didn't hurt themselves. Then the following day, we used to take them out.
Where were you based at this time?
Jessore, which is east of Calcutta. Being special duties, we were confined to camp for the whole of the time that we were doing the special duties. And we used to go out. Day one, as I say, was getting to know the Joes, as we called them. Day two, we used to get up before dawn so that we could take off at dawn. The trips were going to be long. In the back of the Liberator, we used to have a child slide to the back hatch, which we used to put the Joes onto the slide when we used to get to the dropping zone. And then when the green light came on, the dispatcher just used to give them a rather hefty push. And if they grabbed the side, he had a stick which he used to hit their knuckles. Out the back they used to go.
Why did they need a slide to get out? Couldn't they just drop through the hole in the floor?
Well, if you were dropping, say, five, you couldn't drop one at a time, and the dropping zones were literally the size of a cricket square, and you certainly didn't want to go round again in the conditions that we used to drop in. So we needed them all out, say four out in a cricket pitch, and to do that they had to go out one, two, three, literally.
Like, the hatch must be pretty big, mustn't it?
I should say it was about 3 foot by 3 foot.
Uh-huh.
So it wasn't a standing up side. You literally had to drop out of it.
They're all on static lines.
They're all on static lines.
Yeah. Interesting when you say they were French Mackie, because it's all very well. You can drop a European into Europe and he can blend in the background.
Yes.
But to drop a European into an Oriental country, this involved a tremendous risk, didn't it?
Well, yes, it did. But you've got to remember that the French controlled French Indochina prior to the war, and it wasn't uncommon to see Frenchmen around there, rather like tea planters in Malaysia.
They weren't interned by the Japanese.
They had to keep out of the way. Out of the way, and their jobs basically were to raise sabotage groups, and once they were in, if they wanted anything, then it was our responsibility to resupply them or to supply them. So that once they dropped in, if they wanted Sten guns or something like that, then we were the people that took them in, because we knew where we dropped them and we knew where the dropping zone was. The major problem, of course, was the weather. And we had a 78% casualty rate on the squadron.
Really?
And only one was actually shot down by the Japanese. All the rest were the weather.
Turned to mountains or ran out of fuel.
That's the kind of thing. So it was
Did you get much trouble from enemy fighters? Did you have to fight your way out of any
situation? No, not really. We were attacked a couple of times, but because of the job that we were doing, they had taken all the armour plating and all the guns out of the aircraft anyway. So the only way that you could protect yourself was to go into the nearest cumulonimbus and stay in there for a half an hour, knowing that the Zeros would then have gone away, and come out and hope you hadn't twisted the airframe, which was a very, very practical consideration. It was a battle with the weather, won, and a battle in finding where the dropping zones were, because the maps were really appalling, and to a very large extent we made up our own maps as we went to various places and had made various pinpoints which we subsequently use to get us to other dropping zones. It was a very...
It's a very featureless country, Vietnam, isn't it?
Yes, basically it's rivers are the major features, the Irrawaddy and the Sekong and so forth. And bends in those rivers were all important to us. We had a very good navigator who was as young as we were. The navigator was only 19, but he was a splendid chap. And we were very successful. Where a lot of people didn't carry out the operation, we only came back with our load on one occasion. It was one of these cases where politics ruled, because the Americans were in South China and they could have done Hanoi in 2 hours. It took us about 16 hours to do it. But the Americans wouldn't support the French in their colonial French Indochina, would have nothing to do with it, which was very galling, because as I said earlier on, our casualty rate was exceedingly high, and this was because of the weather and having to fly 16, 20 hours in that kind of weather was not pleasant. I kid you not.
Did you have an autopilot to help you on the line?
Yes, we had an autopilot, which was a very good instrument, but needless to say, it came down to actually manually flying the aircraft when things things got difficult. To give you an example, I remember one trip coming back, the cumulonimbus in those areas go up to anything 36, 38,000 feet, and we initially were flying or could be flying at something like 10,000 feet on the way back. And we went in, we couldn't get round a line of cumulonimbus and had to go into the cumulonimbus. And you had to fly attitude because speed or anything like that, you could have absolutely zero forward speed on your airspeed indicator, and your vertical speed indicator could be off the clock, either up or down. The altimeter used to unwind or wind up, as the case may be. And having gone in at something like 15,000 feet, we actually found ourselves at 28,000 feet, flying straight and level all the time. And equally, suddenly, you would come down that in the updrafts and downdrafts in a cumulonimbus.
So when you say flying attitude, it's flying on the artificial horizon.
That's right.
Yeah.
And that's the only thing you you could fly on. And
were you pressurised?
Oh, no.
Really?
No. And two aircraft on the squadron doing exactly the same thing, not voluntarily, but having no alternative but to go into a line of cumulonimbus, actually had their fuselages twisted, and when they got back to base, the aircraft had to be written off. It was a very interesting period, because the various intelligence agencies, there were five intelligence agencies in the Far East, and it quickly became apparent that one didn't speak to the other. So you could have the annoying situation where you went out and did a 22-hour trip to, shall we say, drop an agent and drop the equipment to go with him. You would come back, and then your next trip would be to drop a wireless about 20 miles away from where you had just been, which you could have easily done on the, but it was from a different agency. And the left.
What were the five agencies?
OSE, Force. Oh dear, one, two. The figure eludes me.
I mean, were there some American?
No.
No, they were all
British.
Yeah.
There was a counterintelligence, one I remember, I didn't fly on it, but they needed to drop a body into Burma with false papers to give them...
Literally a dead body.
Literally a dead body.
Yeah.
With a satchel with important papers on, which were all false, so that we knew, or they knew, the Japanese would pick him up, read the papers, and they hopefully would put the Japanese army in exactly the wrong place. And this was an interesting one, because the trouble was was to find a Burmese who had recently died, and in point of fact they eventually found one that or we were on the outlook for one who died in Calcutta, and having died they then got his body up to us at Jessore, and we had the problem of in that hot weather of keeping him reasonably recently killed, in as much as we were going to have to drop him dead, and it would have to appear that he had died on the drop. The problem was he soon began to smell rather badly, so they had to put rose water all over him, which luckily the Burmese tended to do anyway as a toiletry, and this chap was put into a Dakota, sent over, dropped at an appropriate place where they knew he would be found, and it did do the job. The Japanese got the documents and they put their forces in the wrong place when we were actually going back into Burma, and it was a great success.
Were you only flying Liberators on the squadron?
Yes, I flew a Dakota, although we had Lysanders. I didn't fly Lysanders. My main aircraft was the Liberator.
Can you remember any other particular incidents during this time? Have they mentioned dropping?
Well, it's interesting, and you look back and you feel embarrassed about it all. But we used to go in by ourselves, and we only had the two tail guns. There was no other defence, and therefore one used to fly basically as low as one could, as being the safest part. And we used to drop leaflets as a diversion, so the Japanese would think that was our main purpose, dropping leaflets telling them to surrender or whatever they said. But in doing that, we soon became aware of where all the prisoner of war camps were. And pathetic as it may be, we used to buy ourselves tins of fruit and things like that and make our own parachutes and drop fruit into the prisoner of war camps, which was pathetic when you realise what the inmates were going through. And certainly they would have never have got any, but this is what we used to do, and we used to drop bundles of magazines in on them as well. At least it showed them that we knew where they were, and I suppose to a certain extent, when the end of the war came, we were able to fly in. Well, we didn't personally, but aircraft to fly in and bring them out.
Presumably your agents divulged the locations of these camps, did they? Or how did you get to know about them?
Well, I don't really remember. I mean, we just came across them. As I said earlier on, the maps were appalling, therefore we tended to make up our own maps. And a prisoner of war camp was pretty obvious as you flew around Siam and places like that, and I think that's how we picked it up. I'm sure that, although I can't remember, I'm sure the intelligence people probably told our navigator or something like that there was a prisoner of war camp at so and so, and therefore to keep steer clear of it. But I can't recall any direct. But it was a very interesting time.
This work continued right up to the dropping of the bomb, did it?
Yes, it did, and literally after the bomb as well, we continued supplying these people. After the war was over, and in fact the nearest I got to being shot was a bullet from a rifle which bedded itself in the headrest by my head, then that was way after the war was over.
So you still had these isolated Japanese units?
I can't remember what they, I think they were called Annamites, who were against the French. Hmm. They weren't Japanese, because
Ho Chi Minh's lot, were they?
That's the beginning of it. Yeah. Yes. Hmm. So from there, I returned to the UK just before the Christmas of 45, and from there went on to Dakotas in Transport Command. I was posted to 46th Squadron at Dakota Squadron, which at the time was at Manston. We moved from Manston to Abingdon and later on to Oakington, and we used to do the scheduled services throughout Europe in 1946-1947. I tended to do the diplomatic runs to Berlin, Warsaw, Frankfurt and Vienna. There were other trips to Hamburg, Hanover, and places like that.
This is what, personnel as well as diplomatic bags?
Yes, personnel as well as diplomatic bags. But we used to take the King's Messenger with us on these runs, which once again was very interesting, because the battle, by and large, was with the weather, which I was accustomed to. And where you had British European Airways doing similar runs to Berlin, it was always a challenge that we should always get through when the British European Airways were grounded. We used to work out of Northolt, which was the airport for London at the time. And collectively, the 46th Squadron and 30th Squadron were the other squadron that did these runs. We never cancelled going into Warsaw, despite the snow and despite the cloud base down to 100 feet and so forth. We used to go through.
Could you do Warsaw in one go, or did you have to stop on the way?
No, we used to stop in Berlin, because you had to do... the Russians would only allow us in and out of Warsaw in one day. You couldn't night stop at Warsaw. In fact, you had to stay with your aircraft whilst you were at Warsaw. You weren't allowed out of the aircraft. So I was accustomed to European flying when the airlift first started.
Now, Europe at that time, presumably, I mean, it had no ground aids, did it? I mean, you had to fly by DR or...
Yes, it was very, very rudimentary. We used to have G, which was used by Bomber Command during the war, which we had in our aircraft. GCA had just established itself. And that was, they had a unit at Gatow, but there was nothing anywhere else going into Vienna or going into Warsaw. There was no aids whatsoever, and it was just a matter of using your eyeball to get in.
I mean, when you compare it with Europe now, with the airways and VOR everywhere.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was absolute basic.
There is the tail.
Yes, absolutely basic eyeballs and a stopwatch type flying. Once again, very interesting.
Any particularly interesting trips you did?
Not really, because once again, one was not exactly encouraged, but one, because of my previous job, I used to wander away from the main track to see what I could see elsewhere. One used to have a look at Russian airfields and things like that to see what they had on them. And then report.
They didn't show you away then?
No, they didn't. It was an interesting situation, because when I was on the Berlin airlift, flight refueling Lancastrian came down in the Russian zone, and I was the junior member of a board of inquiry in which we had to go into the Russian zone to see the aircraft and indeed to see the aircrew. Who were in hospital in the Russian zone, and we were taken to the local Russian commissar and had to give our identification cards to him for checking. There's a wing commander, squadron leader, and myself. I was a flight lieutenant at the time, and we did our job, and they were handed back to us in the evening. and the two my senior members of the board were handed back without comment, and they handed mine back, and they said, Flight Lieutenant Arscott, we know all about you and your straying off the narrow path when you go into Warsaw.